This is the podcast for Physics 2710 Introductory Modern Physics for 24th of January, 2007. We skipped over briefly a couple of things in the first half of Chapter 3 yesterday that we semi-promised ourselves to come back to and review again. And one of those in particular is the photoelectric effect. But maybe one way to get a running leap at this is to go to the PowerPoint presentations. And we'll just kind of review all these slides all the way up to the photoelectric effect. So let's make sure everybody can see the PowerPoint. So we'll just kind of leaf through these at whatever pace we can go and just catch ourselves up. We've talked about most of this stuff, but I would like your questions to drive our discussion. So ask whatever you want, whenever you want to. Otherwise, I'll kind of flip through these. We talked about X-rays. Coming off the glass, we'll see later, they can also be created by coming off the anode as well, but these X-rays were discovered in 1895 and they go right through your hand. The cathode rays, the machine, the evacuated tube is called the cathode ray tube, and it's used in a couple of different ways for different experiments and purposes. It took us a while to figure out what it was that was going across the tube. Remember, we sucked the air out of the tube, there's a vacuum in there. Now, depending on how much air you suck out, you might still see a faint glow as the cathode rays go across. If they knock into any remaining air molecules in there, you might see a glow. But if you suck really a lot of the air out of there, then you don't see those as they traverse across the tube, only when they hit stuff at the other end. But there's a large potential difference between the two ends of the tube, which accelerates those cathode rays. So they go very, very fast. And it took us a while until we figured out that it was electrons. The cathode rays were electrons.
I have a question about that. We know that it's not a wave because waves cannot be deflected by magnetic fields. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'll go along with that.
So, not that we can see the particle necessarily, but that we see it hit something at the other side and do something. Couldn't waves do that also?
Yes, but these things can be bent by those magnetic fields.
And there's no wave that can be bent?
Everybody here is looking at me.
We were confused just enough in the other class.
They're skeptical. They think I've been pulling their leg too much lately. Until we get to next chapter when we talk about wave-particle duality, Deb, and we'll find out that electrons are both particles and waves at the same time, or maybe even better said, they're neither one, they're something else that has attributes or characteristics or manifestations of both waves and particles. When we get to that point, then maybe my answer will change. But for today, I will say that waves are not bent by magnetic fields.
Okay, I'll buy that.
Got to do baby steps here. Any other questions on that issue? Anyone? So there's the X-ray tube and the hand. You see the... Yeah, all right. Now, this gets to be a little more interesting. This is kind of Thompson's apparatus. I don't know if it's big enough to clearly see on the screen, but it's in your book. This is actually very, very reminiscent of a rudimentary television. Some of you have asked, how do your TVs work? And this is kind of how they work. You get a cathode and boil off electrons. You accelerate them with electric fields. And then you deflect them, both with electric and magnetic fields that you see here, the deflecting plates and the magnet, and you make it paint across your television screen. And we're not talking about LCD panels. We're talking about old-time tube TVs. And the tube is, in fact, the front here. We're on this diagram. It's labeled fluorescent screen. You're on the right side of that looking toward the left. You're looking at the fluorescent screen, and it's glowing. And the electrons are hitting it from behind the tube from where your perspective is. Does that make sense?
Yeah, what's amazing to me is that you can draw that signal as fast as they do.
Yes, it does happen very quickly. You're absolutely right. And they paint across, that beam only hits one spot on the fluorescent screen at a time, and so they have to go by and paint every pixel row by row 30 times a second. It's really quite amazing.
Is that why when you see when you're looking at a TV screen and the TV screen is putting a picture of another TV screen on it, you're getting all those interference patterns because your TV screen is interfering with the signal from the other TV screen? Talking about?
Yes.
Whenever you watch a movie and you're watching someone watching a movie, there's always the interference pattern.
Yeah, the time I see that the most is when I take a videotape of something on TV or on even on a computer screen, and then it doesn't happen with LCD panels. If you take a regular TV movie camera and tape your TV, you'll see the phenomenon that Deb is talking about because they're not in sync. This painting of the lines is not in sync with the other machine, which is also painting lines approximately the same frequency, but not in sync. However, if you take your video camera recorder and point it at an LCD computer screen, you won't ever get that pattern because they just paint all the time and they just change when they need to. So it's a different technology.
I've taken a picture of a TV and it's like usually get a half screen.
Half screen, because that's right where you caught it when it was painting it.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Mm-hmm. That's cool.
It makes sense now. I was wondering why it was...
Doesn't have to always happen. You might be lucky and catch it just right, but anyway.
Is that also like if I stick a magnet by it, it changes the colors because it like pulls me in the air?
I'm not inviting you to my house. That can ruin
the TV. I did
it
when I was a kid.
It can ruin the TV. You're lucky if it didn't.
I did it to my grandma's TV.
You were a precocious budding physicist even then.
Yep.
Yes, it's precisely because of this slide up here. Is that a magnet? Yeah, we've got a magnetic field up there, and it's bending the path of the electrons. So if you hold a magnet up to your television, it will bend that beam of electrons. It's headed really towards your face, but then it's intercepted by the screen, the fluorescent screen. And you can bend those and have it go in other ways and hit the wrong pixels and change the colors. And if you're not careful, it can ruin it. Now, in the olden days when we had CRT computer monitors, some of the more high-end scale ones would have a degaussing button on them, and that was supposed to restore it so that if you had done that kind of magnetic stuff or moved it around relative to the Earth's magnetic field, you could realign it and recalibrate it so it would...
You can push it and it looks like if you did it with the magnet.
Yeah.
If you don't need to.
Yeah, and then it's supposed to fix. The one on the screen, Thompson's experiment, we're bending this beam of cathode rays or electrons with magnetic fields, and you can also do it with electric fields, and both of them are on this picture. The two arrows that are pointing down the page, the blue ones, are electric fields, and then the circles with the X's inside of them, those are magnetic fields, and they're both present, and you can adjust those together so you can have the beam go straight through, and then you know something about the ratio of the two kinds of fields, the force due to the electric field, the force due to the magnetic field, and you can then compute the charge to mass ratio. The math is kind of interesting. It's not particularly difficult. It's a little bit beyond where we've got to, where we have arrived at. What's the right English here? Where we've gotten to in our other physics class. So we won't dwell on it too much here today, but we're going to get to this fairly soon in our other class. And Deb and Teresa have already had that class, so they know all the stuff that's on the screen now. The bottom equation is the one. It says Q over M, that's charge over mass, that's the charge to mass ratio, and we'll measure that in one of our upcoming labs, and it will be equal to the equation you see there. We also talked about this probably in more depth than other topics, and so I'll just skip this unless you have questions. This is another one of the experiments we'll do this semester in our other class. Here's some of the equations you need to do that. I guess the bottom line here, the bottom number, is the final answer. This is the value you get out of the Millikan oil drop experiment. You find out that the charge on one electron is 1.6 times 10 to the negative 19 coulombs. Oh, I think lots of books use E for this. You know, if you're talking about electron charge rather than just a generic any old charge, you generally write an E. So E, it's the charge on the electron, only it's negative on an electron. It's equal, also exactly the same as the charge on the proton, but it's positive there. And that's the amount. And we measured that in the Millikan oil drop experiment. Line spectra. I just got to thinking today, maybe for the sake of Deb and Teresa, I might want to try and figure out a way to show them the spectra that we looked at in class with the diffraction gratings with the glass tubes of gas. I don't know. Deb and Teresa, have you ever seen that experiment done before where you take a little piece of plastic or glass or something that has many slits etched into it, a diffraction grating, and looked at a glowing discharge tube of various types of gases and seen their spectra? Have you ever done that?
I just got done in chemistry last semester, had to do it, and we had to make the comparison between what we saw and what was experimentally accepted. So I'm good.
Okay, Teresa, have you ever done that experiment?
No, I never have. I've seen pictures of it, but that's all.
I'm wondering if the technology would allow us to do that in over the EdNet business here, but maybe we'll have to be clever and see if there's a way that we could hold up the diffraction grating to the camera and see if this would work. I guess it ought to in theory. Everybody ought to see it at some point in their life.
I would be really interested to see you make that work.
I actually did it once in another class, but it was in the old days of EdNet when everything worked. Anyway. I guess there's a picture of what I'm talking about, a schematic diagram. The high voltage is to excite the gas. This is the tube of gas. It's thin. You take out most of the, it's kind of a vacuum. Take out most of the gas out of there. But then you can excite it with this high voltage, and it glows, and you send it through the diffraction grating, and the different colors, these different wavelengths here, of course, correspond to different colors. So it spreads out the colors that are unique patterns for each individual element, each individual chemical element. And it's a very, very, very important tool for astronomers because it tells us about everything we possibly could know about the stars and the sky and the galaxies. We know everything we know from the light we get, and pretty much. And the spectra tells us what they're made of and how hot they are, and we get indications of how old things are and how far away they are, all by looking at the light and the spectrum that we get. And so this is a very important technique. Here's one of the series that you get. This is the one in the visible range. You see, in fact, if you've done this experiment recently, maybe you'll remember looking at a hydrogen spectrum and seeing a deep red line and a teal line, I think I said in class, the blue-green one you see labeled here, and a couple of violet lines. Then some other ones, but they're hard to see. But those few are really bright and easy to see in a good hydrogen tube. However, if you could look at the same spectrum, the same tube of hydrogen, with ultraviolet glasses or infrared glasses, you might see different lines. These are the ones we see because we have visible eyes. But we see here that there's other series they're called. The Lyman series is in the ultraviolet, and then this other series, Paschen bracket and Fund series, are in the infrared. The numbers to the right, do they mean anything to anybody? The N and the K? Well, other than the fact that they correspond to this N and this K, that's what these are. And if you plug in those numbers for N and K, you will, in fact, reproduce the values of the wavelengths that it really works. You actually get them. But physically speaking, in a hand-waving sort of way, what would you tell Grandma about what N and K correspond to physically?
Natural numbers.
They might. Well, they are natural numbers, but physically, what are they in terms of the hydrogen atom?
Oh. Well, Bart.
But we're not there yet. Yes, in fact, look on page 136. This is just a little ahead of where we are, but it ties in. In fact, they revisit the Rydberg formula on page 135. And Bohr predicts new wavelengths. And then the diagram on page 136, figure 16, shows these different series as electrons make jumps from one energy level to another. So N and K correspond to energy level orbits of an electron in a simple hydrogen atom. And when you're talking about N equals 2 as the lower end of that, so look in the very middle of the diagram where it says Balmer series, the arrows are pointing from higher lines down to N equals 2. Those energies or wavelengths are the ones that are in the visible range, and those are the ones we see with our little diffraction grating. The ones in the series on the left, the Lyman series, they have much greater energy gaps, energy jumps, and that corresponds to a shorter wavelength, higher frequency light, and so we don't see those, and those are in the ultraviolet region of the spectrum. Now, you can see these if you can put on your ultraviolet glasses. We don't have glasses per se, but we do have instrumentation that can see all of these lines. You can look in the infrared, and you can look in the ultraviolet with certain equipment, and you can see all of these different series. Jacob?
I was just wondering, the Rydberg equation, is there other numbers for R sub H that would work for other elements, or is there other formulas, or does this stuff just work for hydrogen?
Yeah, this is reproduced in Chapter 4, but in Chapter 3 it's on page 90. The Rydberg equation is kind of a generalization of the Balmer equation. If you compare the two, you'll see that the Balmer equation only gives you the Balmer series, because he didn't know that you could have other N's. But the Rydberg generalizes it. It's a good question. The answer, unfortunately, is this equation works very, very well for hydrogen and not very well for anything else, with the exception of Rydberg-type atoms, which are... That is to say, this doesn't work very well for normal, regular, other atoms like helium, lithium, beryllium, boron. Doesn't work very well for those because the interactions between the orbits are different and it's much more complicated. However, if you can come up with an atom that has some inner electrons that are very held closely held to the nucleus, tightly bound in nearby, and then you have one other electron in a large orbit, like N equals 25 or something like that, it looks down at the nucleus and the inner electrons, and it sees just one packet of charge, then you get Rydberg-type behavior that can follow this with a different R sub H. As long as you're talking about that one lone, far-away electron looking back at the rest of the atom and seeing it as kind of a nucleus, even though there are a few electrons going around in there. That makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
We also talked about quantization of charge and that an electron is a fundamental particle and you can't break one in half. But protons are not fundamental particles, and you can, well, you can't break them in half either, but you can see inside them and see that they're made of three little things, hard things inside, and we call those quarks, and they seem to have fractional charges in the amount of plus or minus one-third and plus or minus two-thirds. It's not any old random number. Don't think that because these aren't integers that you can have any number. No, it's plus or minus one-third and plus or minus two-thirds. That's it. You can have particles made of three quarks, like the proton and the neutron that we mentioned last time. You remember how you get these quarks to add up to a positive one charge if there's three of them? Remember how we did that? Plus two-thirds, minus one-third. And how did we get them at for the neutron to add up to zero?
Two minus one-thirds and one plus two-thirds?
Yeah. Plus two-thirds, minus one-third, minus one-third. So we can get positive 1 and 0. We can also get negative 1 similarly. But there are other particles that only have two quarks in them, and we don't see any fractional charges on those either. They can be positive if you have a plus 2 thirds and a plus 1 third, or 0 if you have a plus 1 third and a minus 1 third. So you can create integer charged particles with two quarks or with three quarks. We'll talk more about that in Chapter 14, I think. Black body radiation. Oh, did I hear a question?
Do quarks have mass then?
A great question. The answer is yes. Let me see if I can find a chart of these. Look on page 490. It tells you the names of the six quarks. I have not used these terminologies yet, but there they are. There's six of them. And it lists their mass and their charge and a whole bunch of other stuff that we'll study in Chapter 14. On the next page, 491, table 14.6, you'll see some mesons that are made up of two quarks and some baryons that are made up of three quarks. In each case, the total charge has to add up to an integer value.
I'm sorry, what did you say? It has to add up to a...
integer value.
Integer, okay.
Negative 1, 0, or 1 in general.
We have all these crazy particles. How come we never hear of them anywhere else?
There were a number of them. In fact, if you combine these in this chart, this table 14.6, this is just the bare scratchings of the beginning. In the 1950s, in our atom smashers, we started seeing these particles. And you can also think that if you've got six of them to play with, six quarks, U, D, S, C, B, and T, and you can combine them in any combination, more or less, then you're actually going to come up with a lot more than the ones that are listed in table six. You actually get a couple hundred of them, and it gets to be overwhelming to try to remember all of their names. And Enrico Fermi, one of the world's famous physicists of the 20th century, used to say, if I had wanted to memorize the names of all of these particles, I would have become a botanist. Ooh, that's a low blow. Anyway, the reason we don't talk about these too much is because we organized them by the quarks. When we didn't know that they were made of quarks, there really were 200 fundamental particles. Then we said, that's too many. God wouldn't make 200 fundamental particles, most of which you don't see in daily life. So maybe there's some underlying structure that explains how you can get all these, and that's where the quarks come from. I guess that's one answer to your question. The other is, we really don't see hardly any of these in daily life. We only see these in our atom smashers. What we only see in daily life, you go out in nature and look around, all you see is the first two of the quarks, the up and the down. That's all you'll ever see. Then sometimes you'll see a couple of these mesons in cosmic rays, like the mu mesons that we talked about from the relativity experiment. I found the chart I was looking for. Page 481, there you can see the muon. That's the ones that were in the problem at the end. So black body radiation we spent a lot of time on in the first chapter, and so this would be a good just time to take stock and see if you understand it and have any questions. This cavity on the screen is a black body, meaning that it absorbs light, but it doesn't reflect light. That's the whole point of this picture here. A light ray might come in, and then it would bounce around. You can see the arrows getting thinner and thinner and thinner until it's finally absorbed, because it's just, it's not 100% reflective inside. But it gets bounced around so many times that it gets absorbed before it ever escapes back out. In that sense, light can come into this object and not bounce back out of it. So it absorbs all the radiation, but it doesn't reflect any. However, if it keeps doing this, if more and more rays go in the hole and bounce around and it gets absorbed, then its temperature goes up, and then it begins to glow due to its temperature, like all black bodies do. So this was, when we looked in our hands, this was what I was trying to show you. A cavity acts like a black body because light can go in, but it doesn't reflect back out. That's why it looks black, because it's cold. If you look in this thing that were really, really hot, though, if you looked in this, put your eyeball right here and look inside there, if it were hundreds of degrees, it would glow. Light would be coming out the hole, but not because it's reflected light. It would be emitted light. And the whole point of this black body stuff is these curves. The Rayleigh-Jeans equation is the classical explanation for these. Do we have a Rayleigh-Jeans? We do. Right here, the Rayleigh-Jeans equation was the best classical explanation we had for these black body curves, but they just go up and up and up and up and up, and they never bend back down like they're supposed to, like the experimental data says they should. And there it is. There's the Rayleigh-Jeans formula. And it has no H's in it. I want you to take careful note of that. No H's, because it's a classical formula. What did we skip? Yeah, that's okay. But it doesn't work. And so Planck came along and had to modify the equation. This is the same quantity over here, same thing he's trying to graph, but it's got stuff in it now that the other one didn't have. This H here and this H here mathematically make, just kind of trial and error, play around with the data and make it fit. Take this equation, it doesn't work, that's this dotted line, but if you just play with it and try and make it fit this, and then you might tend to stick in a little constant like that, and lo and behold, it works really, really well. But remember, he understood what the implication of this H was, and so he hoped that in the limit it would go to zero. and we could still keep the nice blackbody curves, but not have a quantized unit. Well, it didn't work, so we ended up with a quantized universe, and there's the value of H, Planck's constant. If you like to memorize things, that would be fifth or sixth on your list to memorize.
For the intensity, that relative intensity,
yes,
is that is the intensity defined as the amount of light over a period of time?
Not over a period of time, just at any given time.
Okay, at any given time, but over a certain area?
Over an area, yes. I would say that, that this is normalized for a specific amount of area. The intensity is a function of the wavelength and the temperature. And the way we see that is, right here, you can see various curves corresponding to various temperatures. That shows you that the intensity is a function of temperature. And then across the axis down here is the wavelength. So the function, that the quantity I is a function of the wavelength. And then because there are different curves on here, that's also a function of the temperature. Normally, the way we would graph a function of two variables is with a plane for the domain, and then you'd have the answer, the dependent variable, come up into the third dimension. You'd try and draw a 3D graph where I is the height of it, and this would be one axis, and this would be another axis in the original plane. And you can almost kind of see that in this picture right here a little bit. If you imagine maybe that there are a third axis going back this way, that was the T-axis, the temperature axis, then each of these curves would be in a different T-plane. One of the websites I sent you about the black body information has a 3D graph like that, and you can go see it drawn back into the third dimension. But that's all we mean by this. It's a function of both wavelength and temperature, but it's normalized for the amount of area. Certainly, as Deb points out, a gigantic thing that's at 3,000 Kelvin is going to radiate a lot more energy and light than a little tiny thing at the same temperature. So we normalize it for the area. We say per unit of area, then it's going to emit this much radiation. In doing so, we found out that the energy of a photon is equal to H times the frequency, so the same H shows up in this equation, and you will hardly even be able to begin to count up the number of equations that H shows up in from here on out.
I have a question. Why now? Explain to me why H quantizes it, because it can't be just because it's a constant, I mean, mathematically.
What Planck postulated was that you can't divide up the energy of this radiated light from the black body object infinitely small divisions in however small pieces you want to. His postulate was, well, maybe these come in packets or chunks whose energy is given by this formula at the bottom here, HF, the one right down there. If you do that, then the F is the frequency, that's the inverse of the wavelength. So on this diagram right here, you want to go, where's my cursor? You want to go left for increasing frequency. And what he's saying is the way you can make this curve bend down is if you postulate that each chunk of small wavelength or high frequency light actually carries more energy than one packet or one chunk of light from this region of the curve, which has a longer wavelength and a lower frequency. So the H that quantizes it, it is this H here, but that you can see the quantum effect better in this equation right here. You might say, oh, well, that doesn't necessarily make your curve jumpy. It's not a discrete function now. You can still get a smooth curve out of that, so how did the H quantize it? Well, this is where the H quantizes it. The postulate is that chunks of ultraviolet light carry more energy per chunk than chunks of red light or infrared light do.
Because the wavelengths are discrete? Is that what you're saying?
You can have any wavelength you want, but because for any wavelength, you have packets of light that have a certain amount of energy given by this formula.
Okay.
So you don't get as many packets of ultraviolet light being emitted, but each one of them has a lot of energy in it. Photoelectric effect. We need to get through this and a couple more things before the end of the hour. The photoelectric effect is the idea that you can shine light on a metal and get an electric current out of it. You put it in a vacuum tube so that the electrons can
go again, and you shine light in here, instant light, and it releases electrons that then come over here and jump into the collector. And since the electrons are going this way, it means the current is actually going the other way. Now, if this were a pure vacuum in here and nothing were jumping across, you wouldn't have any current flowing. The ammeter would read zero. There'd be no current flowing. And that's the case when there's no light. If you turn off this light, then no current flows. But if you shine the light on here and it releases these electrons out of the emitter and they jump over here, that constitutes the current in the tube. And then they can run around all the way around the rest of the circuit. What's the classical explanation for this? Experimental results. The kinetic energies of the photoelectrons are independent of light intensity. What does that mean? That means that if you shine a brighter light here, that these electrons do not come off any faster. Say that again. If you shine a brighter light on here, the electrons do not come off faster, which you might have expected in a classical explanation. So we'll have to think about how to explain this. Why doesn't a brighter light give these photoelectrons more energy? Why doesn't it do that? The maximum kinetic energy of the photoelectrons for a given emitting material depends only on the frequency, or alternatively, the inverse of the wavelength, or another word for that is color, of the light. So that means that if you change this light from one color to another, you can change the kinetic energy of this thing, of the electrons that are coming off. Okay? The maximum kinetic energy depends only on the frequency, not the brightness or the intensity. Smaller the work function of the emitter material, the smaller is the threshold frequency. We haven't talked about work function in class, but he mentions it where?
In the minimum binding energy.
Right. You see it in the graph on page 899 in figure 13. It's the intercept of the line there. When photoelectrons are produced, their number is proportional to the intensity of light. Now, that might be surprising, but that's what we see. That is, if you change the light intensity, you don't change the number of photons. You do change the number of photons. You don't change the kinetic energies of the The electron. Okay, I'm back up. Forget that sentence. I'll start over. What we said here in number one is that changing the amount of light or the intensity of the light does not change the speed at which the electrons come off, but it does change the number of them. If you change the incident light by making it brighter, you get more photoelectrons, which means a greater current, which you can measure with the ammeter. Brighter light means more photoelectrons. You can kind of detect how fast they're going by what they do at the collector. They might emit x-rays or do some other things if they're very energetic. You can, I mean, it may not be your first thing to do, but if you decide to look at that, you can see how fast they're going. Let's see. The photoelectrons are emitted almost instantly following the illumination of the photocathode, independent of the intensity. What they're saying here is that in a classical explanation, if this is a wave and you shine these wavy things onto the emitter, you would actually think that it would take a reasonable amount of time for the electrons in the emitter to gather up or collect enough energy to jump out of the metal. Waves are spread out things, and they kind of wash over these electrons. As the light waves are coming in, the electrons would kind of absorb more energy as these waves kind of wash over them. Finally, the electron has enough energy, more than the work function, and it jumps out and then goes across the vacuum to the collector. That would be the classical idea, but it's clearly wrong because there is no time delay. The instant you turn on the incident light, it doesn't take any time at all for these guys to collect up enough energy to jump out. They do so immediately. And so the classical explanation fails there, too. You would have thought it might have taken seconds or even minutes for enough energy to collect, and it doesn't. The instant you turn on the light, you get photoelectrons. Those are all in your book. Classical interpretation? Well, you probably... Yeah, go ahead.
I have a question about that second sentence, basically, right in the classical interpretation of number one. However, the classical theory predicts that the total amount of energy in the light wave increases as the light intensity increases. Is that what you were just talking about? That the energy, classical physics said that the energy of the light wave is related to the light intensity?
Yes.
So that's what they thought, that was the leading theory at the time.
Right, and another thing back on this number 5 down here, I emphasized up to the comma already, but maybe I didn't emphasize this last part, independent of the intensity of light. Classically, you would expect that if the light is more intense, then those waves would carry more energy, and they would wash over those electrons gathering energy faster. They'd collect up energy in a quicker fashion, and they'd be able to jump out of the emitter faster or sooner after the light has turned on if your light is bright. But we don't see that. We do not see that.
I guess what I'm asking is, in the classical theory, did they somehow see that increase in the intensity increased the energy?
It's part of your classical electricity and magnetism, Maxwell's equations, the intensity is directly related to the energy in the wave. Yes.
Okay,
so here's the classical explanation for all this, but you know now that a lot of these don't hold. They don't match what we actually see. In other words, if you're a classical physicist in 1880 and someone says, hey, did you know that if you shine light on a metal that it can release? Well, you didn't even know about electrons in 1880, but you'd get a current flowing in this little circuit. How would you explain that? Well, you'd try, and you'd come up with this. But if you look closely, you'd find out that your explanation doesn't really match all of the features of the experimental data that we see. It fails at a number of points. So Einstein comes along, and he makes this assumption. Notice this is the same one that Planck had to make for the blackbody radiation. And what we're saying is that the light is not coming in these extended waves, washing over the electrons, allowing them to gather energy gradually. What we're saying is now the energy, the light, is coming in packets, little small individual packets of energy. So if you make the light brighter, do these go faster? Well, classical physics would have said yes. Einstein says no. Brighter light corresponds to more packets, more photons. Each photon comes in and deposits all of its energy to one of these electrons. And then the electron, if it's got enough, more than the work function, can immediately jump out. That's why there's no delay. It doesn't have to gather up wavy energy. The packet comes all at once. If it's got enough energy, the electron gets out instantly. If the light is brighter, that means that there are more photons. Each one of those photons can excite another electron. So what do we see when we get a brighter light? More electrons, greater current, but they're not moving faster. So we see this packet idea is helping to explain all this. Incidentally, one of the experimental things we notice is that if the light isn't the right color, that's number 2 here, or 3, 3 also talks about this, then the electrons won't come out at all. That is to say, here in this diagram, if you shine light of the wrong color on this thing, you can leave it on for days and no electrons ever pop out. If you were a classical physicist, you would have said, well, maybe longer wavelength carries less energy, so we just have to wait longer. You know, if it's red light, we'll wait 2 days instead of 2 hours, and those electrons will have enough energy and they'll jump out. But quantum mechanics says they're coming in packets. Red packets don't have enough energy, to more than the work function, to knock them out at all. So you can shine the red light on the metal for 2 weeks, no electrons come out. Shine blue light on the emitter, and instantly, electrons come out. Can't explain that classically. It's easy to explain if you make these assumptions. So the energy of the photon, some of it goes into the work function. It's got to release it from the metal in the first place. Then whatever's left over becomes the kinetic energy of the electron as it moves away. And that helps explain all of the stuff. We're running out of time. Do you have any particular questions about any of this stuff? I haven't gone in great detail on this slide, but any other questions about the difference between the classical and quantum interpretation?
In the quantum, everything was explained, right?
Yes.
So, and then in the classical, there was only some that were explained and the others were...
That is right. That is right. Einstein's theory, remember, he got the Nobel Prize for this, matches what we see precisely. And it's a very nice experiment. In fact, I think I showed you in the other class a laser disc experiment with this, or maybe Sprott. I can't remember, but they shined a ultraviolet light on a gold leaf foil, and it went down. And then they put the glass in between. Glass doesn't pass ultraviolet, and it wouldn't go down. That's this experiment. Einstein's explanation covers it completely. Okay, moving along. X-ray production. We have the cathode ray tube thing here again. We heat up this filament to boil off some electrons. They are accelerated by the electric field. The high voltage power supply makes them attracted over here. So they're gaining speed, and they can smack into this target very fast. And as they hit into the target, they release X-rays. Why do they do that? Why do they release X-rays when they... Well, this picture over here shows you how it happens. This is a blow-up. Here comes the electron. They've changed the orientation, I guess. The electron's coming this direction, which over here in this diagram is this direction. Okay, coming in. It comes by a heavy, massive nucleus, which attracts the electron and makes its path bend. That bending is slows it down and is a braking effect, but we believe in conservation of energy, so as it slows down, it doesn't just lose its energy to nothing. It has to give it up somewhere. We believe in conservation of energy. So if the electron loses energy, then it's got to emit it as this photon right here. So as it comes breaking around the nucleus, it emits this breaking radiation photon. In German, breaking radiation is Bremsstrahlung. So we call this Bremsstrahlung radiation. Bremsstrahlung X-rays. And
I'm a little confused because it says Bremsstrahlung is a process by which an electron is accelerated while under the influence of a nucleus. Why would it be breaking?
This is the physics-y definition of acceleration, which means any change in velocity. Slowing down is an acceleration. And in fact, probably the reason it says it that way is because in an electricity and magnetism chapter, we'll learn that whenever charges are accelerated in any way, they radiate electromagnetic radiation. So this is one case, one way to accelerate the charge, the electron, and the way it's accelerating is by slowing down and changing direction. But any time a charge accelerates, it radiates. And in this case, it's this Bremsstrahlung radiation. This picture is a spectrum of the radiation that you get out. As these electrons come banging into the target, they decelerate at different amounts depending on how close they come to the nucleus and all this stuff. It's all kind of a statistical process. So another one might come right closer here and be accelerated even more. So it might radiate more energy as a photon. So there's going to be a range of energy come out in these X-rays, and that's demonstrated on this graph right here. What they don't talk about here at all are these peaks, but they save that for another chapter. I think that might be in chapter 4 also, what these two sharp peaks are. But ignore those for this discussion. It's the smooth stuff. That's the Bremsstrahlung radiation. As these electrons smash into a chromium target, or a molybdenum target, or a tungsten target. Now, they would be slightly different if you accelerated them at a different speed, but it says in the figure caption for this that they're 35,000 volts, accelerating voltage. That is to say, this voltage right here has 35,000 volts, and you put chromium in there, then you'll get a spectrum of X-rays out that looks like this. Most at this wavelength, a few over here, not very many over here, and zero below this minimum lambda, minimum wavelength. Corresponds to the maximum frequency, the greatest energy ones here, when the electron gives up all of its energy to a photon. Questions before we do the Compton effect? We're getting through this. Compton effect. What can you tell me about that?
It's the photons hitting the electrons and then bouncing back off, kind of like the pool balls colliding.
Okay. And the only way you can talk about pool balls is if you're thinking of the photon as a packet particle kind of like deal. If it's a spread out wave, you don't talk about collisions and pool balls and stuff. So, again, we have to think of light in the photon sense, the packet particle type sense, for this to make any sense to us. Classically, if you have an electron sitting there and a photon comes by and it's a wave, classically, then it would excite this charge. It would feel the undulating electric fields, and it would undulate with the wave. It would go up and down with the frequency of the wave. And then it would re-radiate that energy at the same frequency. And they mention this down here and call it Thompson scattering. So you can have an electron and a photon come by, and it just absorbs and then reacts and re-emits at the same frequency. And you do see that. But what happens is sometimes you get a modified wave that's at a totally different frequency. What is going on then? And for that, we have to do Jacob's assumption that it's kind of like a particle in a sense, and you have to do conservation laws. If you look at this figure, okay, top of page 107, that's not it.
Hey, I have a question about the conservation of momentum.
Okay.
Like, if it has no mass, how do we... This seems like a silly question, but if it has no mass, how can we have... I mean, if we define momentum as mass times velocity, is it because are we equating the energy of the photon?
Let me refer you back to chapter 2, page 65, bottom of the page, equation 271, which talks about massless particles having momentum. In fact, up in equation 269 and 270, you see a relationship between energy and momentum. And even if the m is zero, you would still have, in equation 270, the last term might drop out if you have a massless particle, but you still have the p squared c squared term there. A massless particle has energy and momentum. Weird stuff? Read that little section again. That's also where it mentions that massless particles must travel at the speed of light. They don't have any choice.
Well, when I read it through the first time, when they're going from that, if you look on page 66 and that second to the last, before they say massless particle, gamma times m times c squared is equal to gamma m u c. And then they say, the fact that u and c follows directly from this equation after careful consideration of letting m approach zero, realizing that gamma approaches infinity. I guess in that equation, I didn't understand that. I didn't understand how that follows.
I mean, clearly, algebraically, if you cancel the gammas and cancel the m's, then you're left with c squared equals uc. So algebraically, it's quite manifest. It's not tough. But anyway, experimentally, we do definitely see that light, for example, as one type of massless particle, does carry momentum because we can feel light pressure. In fact, there's talk of putting up a gigantic sail on a spacecraft outside of the Earth's atmosphere and let it sail between the planets based on the momentum it receives from the sunlight. You can also measure this in the laboratory. Shine a really bright laser at something, it can twist a fine wire and you can measure the amount of momentum.
Well, isn't that those radiometers too? The light shines on it. Well, you know what I'm talking about, a radiometer?
Yeah, but no, that's not the explanation for that.
That's not it?
No, but if that were the explanation, it would turn the opposite way from the way it really turns.
So
So what's the explanation for the radiometer?
The explanation for the radiometer is the black side of the veins absorbs the light and heats up. So little molecules of air that happen to be close by get hot, and then they push off fast and push on the black side as a recoil.
Okay, I don't know.
It's on the box. That's the only reason I know that. It's on the box. It's on the radiometer box. Okay. I'm sorry they didn't give me any pictures for the Compton effect, but you need to study figure 318 carefully, especially the angles and all that, because those go into your conservation laws. You want to conserve energy, which is a scalar quantity, and you also want to conserve momentum, both in the x direction and in the y direction. So you end up with three equations, an energy conservation equation, a momentum in the x direction conservation equation, and a momentum in the y conservation equation. And you solve all those, and you can find, then you can then solve for this scattered photon and the direction of the recoil electron. The results are shown in figure 319. As these photons come in at a certain angle, you get some scattered at the modified angle. You still see some photons at the original unmodified angle, but then a few degrees over, half of a degree or something, you see the scattered or modified, and that's due to the fact that, again, in energy conservation, that the electron has recoiled and taken some of the energy. And so the photon that came in can't keep all of that energy. If it gave some of it to the electron, it has to have less now after the fact. And that's why it is at a longer wavelength. That's given in the equation, 342. We are out of time, I'm sorry to say. We'll probably take a few minutes more next time because we did not talk about pair production annihilation, and it's worth at least a mention. We'd like to talk about that briefly. But in general, in order to kind of keep on our schedule, we need to more or less consider ourselves to be mostly through with Chapter 3, and you should read Chapter 4. And if this seems like a fast pace, it will get worse in 8, 9, and 10. We have to read a whole chapter every class day instead of every class week. But I don't think it's too bad, is it? We're not going too fast. The homework's not been too bad. Do you have homework for me, Jacob? Anyway, goodbye, everybody. It's 5 o'clock.
I don't have